You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. Hi, guys. So this week has seemed so long and exhausting. It started out last Sunday with taping the live episode, which went really well in so many ways. I can't believe it's now over and that it really hasn't been that long since it happened. But also in the middle of that, I'm putting up a play. We have our first show tomorrow night. That has all happened very quickly, so my focus has also been put on that. And then obviously the election happened, and as an artist and a human being, and especially as a woman, I was very disappointed and surprised and frankly scared by the outcome of the election. So anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit longer than usual on this episode just to kind of explain about the live episode and how it happened and how it went, and then a little bit about everything else that's going on as well. So on Sunday, the live episode happened. It happened at Arts on Site on St. Mark's Place in the East Village, which is a wonderful, wonderful organization. I believe their website is artsonsite.org. They have great $10 dance classes with really wonderful teachers, and they have affordable rehearsal space, and they really took care of me, and I was so glad that the episode got to happen there. I produced it with Dylan Moore, who has been on the podcast towards the beginning, who was my classmate at Juilliard and is now a producer. Luckily, she was there for me to be my sounding board and to help me tie up all the loose ends and kind of take care of things while I was trying to host and do all of that. We had about 50 people come, and thanks to a generous donation from dear friends, I was able to hire a professional sound person to help me make this happen. And he was so great. We were able to have amplification, which I hadn't really planned on. And it was really helpful because there was an amazing sounding dance company rehearsing upstairs that sometimes would sound like a pack of gazelles going across the floor. I wish I could have seen what they were rehearsing. So the amplification was really helpful. So you might hear a little bit of that in the background here and there. The sad part was that although it was no fault of the sound person at all, but some fluke happened with the memory card, and we only got the first 28 minutes of the event on tape, not the rest. So when we figured out what had happened afterwards, luckily we were all still hanging out, and I was able to re-record Laura's song. So although I do not have her interview on this episode, I do have her song, which I'm grateful for. I already knew that these two interviews were going to be short and sweet, a half hour each. It's not a lot of time to really get into all these deep topics. So I had already thought about recording additional episodes with these guests. So what my plan is to record full episodes in the next couple weeks with Frankie J. Alvarez, my husband, and with Laura, and get those out as soon as I can. But this kind of made the live episode a really special event for everyone who was in the room, and you guys are just going to get a kind of some little bit of highlights and snippets on this recording today. Unfortunately, it stopped right in the middle, or right at the beginning of an answer Frankie was giving to a question about being a Latino actor and handling the challenges that come with that. So I will definitely make sure to ask him about that again when we record in the near future. You'll also hear Brendan Spieth playing the music at the beginning. Brendan and Elena Adcock performed a beautiful rendition of Over the Hill by Luden Wainwright. So I'm sorry, Brendan, that that's not going to be included here, but everyone who was in the room loved it. It was gorgeous. So yeah, that's where I am with it. And honestly, it had me going a little bit to the dark side and questioning how it went the next day and a little bit this week, just because I'm a perfectionist and I was hoping that everything would go perfectly, but there's always things that are out of your control. There are always just, you know, things that randomly go wrong. So I've decided to look at the positive side. It was a great event. We'll do more in the future. And this is really a small thing that could have gone wrong. So I want to say thank you to Dylan Moore for helping me put this together, and everyone else who was there that night, helping me with tickets, with the bar, with photographs. I really can't do it without you guys. So it was really lovely to have all those artists in the room and giving me their support, and the audience giving me their time and their focus. It was wonderful, and I'm very grateful. So that is the live episode, and the audio I have will follow this introduction. So the play that I'm doing right now, kind of suddenly out of the blue, it's come back to life, is called Drunkelvania, and it's with 3 Day Hangover Theater Company. You can find tickets at drunkelvania.com. There's a discount code for 20% off for shows in November, which is the number 3, and then the letters DHFAN, all capital. It's a show I love, and it's heartening that after putting in so many like Equity Showcase code hours on it over the years, it's come back with a real Equity contract for 3 shows a week. So we're going to make a little bit of money and get to tell the story all together. It's a lot of fun. So I hope you come out. Anyway, yesterday when I woke up and saw the results of the election, I was in a daze for a lot of the day. It was very emotional, and we all showed up to have a dress rehearsal in the evening, and it was really heartening just to come together and create something together and find the laughter and the emotion in a Chekhov play is actually very apropos for right now. And there's a large part of the play and my storyline in the play is that you just have to keep going. Like, no matter what happens, you just have to wake up and keep going. So, that being said, that's that. That's the play that's going on. So, I'm sorry if this episode is not as polished as usual, but things have been hectic. Today, I went for a jog around my neighborhood in Astoria, Queens. I love my neighborhood. It's the most diverse borough of New York City. And I went for a little run, and I passed by this elementary school, and a bunch of the kids were out in this little, fenced in, not really a playground, but like a play yard. And this group of boys, maybe like third grade or fourth grade, was kind of jogging around the playground, shouting together, "We hate Trump! We hate Trump! We hate Trump!" and laughing. And it was just the most bizarre thing. And at first, I smiled because it was just so surprising and kind of amazing that they knew what was going on. But I had this surreal moment of having these flashbacks to being a kid, and when some other kid will ask you, "Well, are you a Republican or are you a Democrat?" Not that any of us knew what that meant, but you would say whatever your parents were. Yeah, not understanding it, but you're just kind of taught to echo that. Like, that's what I am. And at first I smiled, and then I also started crying for like 5 seconds, because that's just the place I'm in. And it felt like I was in a sci-fi film where you wake up in a different reality and you don't realize it until you start to notice the small inconsistencies of that reality with what you're used to. And those kids probably don't really know what's going on or what they're saying. And even though I hope their parents are explaining to them what is happening, because it will impact their lives. But I hope that the word hate is abolished from all the children's mouths across the country, whether their parents are Democrats or Republicans, no matter what the candidate who is now going to be our president has encouraged. And we can all work together towards our goals and not hate individuals or groups of people, but work towards putting systems and ideas and thoughts into action that have nothing to do with hating human beings. It was an odd moment, and I wanted to take a deep breath and just share it with you, because I turned on my phone and made a little voice recording because it was just so bizarre. And I'm still thinking about it. the excerpt you're about to hear is with actor Frankie J. Alvarez. He's my husband. We met at Juilliard and we've been together for 10 years, married for 3.5. I respect his hard work and drive so much. And it was a pleasure to finally have him on the podcast, but there's more to come at a later date. This is just a beginning. Again, thank you to Brendan Spieth and Laura Gratmans, and I will have another episode with Laura very soon. I hope you enjoy this little peek into The Compass Live. For coming to The Compass Live. It's our first live episode. There will be more in the future. I'm super nervous, but I'm really glad to see all these friendly faces in the crowd. We are here at Arts on Site. I'm very thankful to them for hosting us. And I'm looking forward to we have Brendan Spieth on music. And my two guests are Frankie J. Alvarez and Laura Gratmans, who are amazing. So we're just gonna get started. So thank you all for being here. It's wonderful to see you all. So, Frankie, this is my husband, for anyone who doesn't know.
Hi.
Now that we've broken the ice.
Have we broken it?
What is the dark side for you artist?
Yeah, we're going to launch right in.
Yeah, as usual. Mm-hmm. And how do you try to avoid going there as an artist? Yeah.
The first thing I wanted to say is... it's a pretty incredible thing that you're doing today, and everybody's very excited about it. To answer that question, I'm gonna try my best to...
There's also a dance rehearsal upstairs, so hopefully if no fans will fall on your heads, hopefully.
But those of you who've already done the podcast in our office know we have two boys that live upstairs. And so this is kind of similar. So it's almost like we're home.
Yeah, it's realistic.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, that's exactly what two boys sound like. I guess I want to make sure that we were talking about having this conversation. Usually it's a private conversation between two people, and there's an intimacy there, and obviously all you guys are here as an audience, and so I gotta try my best to turn off a performance-type energy. Of course that's gonna happen, right? But you know what? This is what we do as artists. We let in what happens in the moment, and that's really what it's all about. So to answer your question, I gotta say first we gotta define what the dark side is, and I know for me, there wasn't really a dark side until I went to grad school.
Yeah?
You know...
What do you mean?
Well, and we've talked about this before, and I'm going to say that again. We've talked about this before, wife. I was kind of a big fish in a small pond in Miami. I went to an all-boy Jesuit school from 6th to 12th grade, and... we acted on tabletops. There was 14 of us at any given time who were actors in a school of 1,000 guys wearing ties and Ivy League jackets, you know? So we were an anomaly at that school. And so it was pretty easy to be considered. I mean, my nickname in high school was Thespis. And I thought it was kind of apropos. I was one of the first actors to step out from this ensemble of future doctors and lawyers and to declare, well, I'm different, you know? So different, in fact, that when I talked to my college counselor and told him about a life in the arts, he was like, good luck.
He's like, I know nothing about that.
He really had no way to sort of steer me. And my mom, we got in a van and we drove to Tallahassee, 7 hours away. And I saw Florida State for the first time. And you have to understand, as a wide-eyed, curious, cute boy, going to college for the first time and actually like seeing girls on campus. And my mom was so sweet, so generous. For those of you who know Ophelia, a lot of you, of course, it won't surprise you to know that we're walking around campus and she's like, check out that lady over there. Look at those booty shorts, you know? And it, for her, it was her way of being like, it's okay, you know? You lived in a different world previously, and this is a whole new world, and you can find your place there. And it was a tremendous act of generosity. I was waitlisted for a bunch of my sort of the colleges that I wanted to go to, and FSU ended up being my safety school. And when I look back on it, it was such a blessing to be 7 hours away from home. I'm a very, as you know, a very family-oriented guy. And that first semester was so, it was tough for me to not have my support system, to not have my sisters and my parents and a lot of my close friends. So anyway, this is the problem with you and I talking. We can talk for hours. I'll be like, oh, thanks for answering that question. Next. So at FSU, I really was, I acted all the time. I was very fortunate to be on the main stage semester after semester. And I had a kind of, I was just throw energy at parts, you know, at characters that I was playing. Just a lot of energy, just too much energy. For those of you who've known me that long, Alejandro Rodriguez is out there, who's the closest thing I have to a blood brother. We've known each other 18 years now, something like that. We've raised a kid in our friendship, right? Don't worry, you'll meet him.
I should know about this.
So I was fortunate to have teachers that believed in me and directors who cast me, and I got to work on a lot of things. So when I came here to the city, it was really a deep realization that, oh, I'm just one of many. So how am I going to stand out? And I booked this TheaterWorks tour to go away from New York for 6 months and play a bunch of funny characters in a touring version of Ramona Quimby. I played Mrs. Greaves, I think, who had I had a beehive wig and boobies, and I was Ramona's funny uncle who went to safari in Africa and came back. And then of course I was Mr. Frost, who worked at the refrigerator factory where Mr. Quimby worked, and I fire Mr. Quimby. And so I played him as a Spaniard. He was Señor Frost. And it was an amazing experience to tour around the country. And I, that was the first time that I really felt a sense of what we do as actors is a service, you know? We were going to elementary schools and middle schools and performing for these kids and helping them realize, oh my God, this is a life, you know? Financially, it wasn't, and we're going to get into that, I'm sure, at some point. But my heart was full, and it was during that time when I auditioned for Juilliard at the behest of my one of my close friends, Ale, who coached my monologues and stuff, and I got in, and I put all my eggs in that one basket.
So what was it that changed when you got into grad school that you felt like you started discovering
right.
the dark side?
Well, then I met my 17 classmates who were beautiful and wonderful, and a bunch of, they were also big fish from their small ponds. And then to realize, well, here we are now in this small pond, and we're pretty big fish here. And, you're so cute when you're worried. this is why she's waited so long for me to be on the podcast. She's worried that I would spend 45 minutes flirting. And here I am, as predictable as ever. But Yeah, so it was a blessing to be around my classmates, and I learned a lot from them. But I very quickly learned that the stuff that the pure energy and talent that I coasted on, there was a lot more work that I needed to do, and I needed to go deeper in that process. And in that, I started to compare myself to other people. And I had never done that previously. Yeah, so I'd never put myself in a place where I'm looking at another classmate and thinking, I wish I was getting that attention, or I wish I was being supported in that way that this person is being supported. And then feelings of envy and jealousy started coming about. And that was, for me, very new. I had never felt that way. And that continues to be, for me, the dark place, you know, where I see somebody else's fortune and I want what they have. And the thing for me that continuously helps is to have like a full audience of people like you guys, who are, a lot of you are close friends. And so realizing that I have a supportive network of people that are champions for me, and that I am champions for them as well, and that is a currency. It's very easy to lose sight of that in the city, and especially in this business that is so competitive, where you're being compared to other people. And so part of me is taking that power away from that comparison. And a really close friend of mine, Alexis, came into town, and we went to drinks in the neighborhood in Astoria. Whoop, whoop. And we're walking down the street to the bar, and he was like, I'm really proud of you, man. And I was like, why are you proud of me? You're gonna be a doctor. And he said to me, you know, my dad was a doctor, and I'm in the family business, and I have family friends that have helped me out and put me in this position. And you went to an all-boy Jesuit school that wasn't an art school, and you found this passion, this talent, and you worked your way. You willed this life for yourself, you know? I took on Juilliard, you know, obviously spiritually, and also, you know, psychologically, but also financially. And that's a burden that I continue to pay, like a second mortgage. And where's that first mortgage?
You don't even have mortgage yet.
Yeah, nice catch. But anyway, it was such a tremendous act of generosity for my friend Alexis to say, you know, you did this, you know? You, from nothing, you made this life for yourself, and it made me realize, wow. I mean, it was just such a beautiful gift, and that only happened a couple weeks ago, and for him to say that to me was just, it hit me like a ton of bricks, that we get stuck. I put these blinders on, and it's between me and this guy for this part, or I really want this play, but I can't even get in the room, and things like that, and then realize, wow, I've come so far in such a short amount of time. And it's really easy to forget that when you're in that grind every day. And to have his outside perspective illuminate that for me was just, it was a gift. It was a gift. So anyway, to answer your question, I mean, that's the thing for me is comparison, you know? And it's something that naturally happens in this business. So I have to find a way to, for me, the way out of it is work, you know? And here you are, you're doing Drunk Ol' Vanya now, and we're running lines together, and we will work, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing for me, where I get back into that script, or back into that play, or whatever it is that if I'm not working on something, whatever audition that pops up, or if I don't have an audition that week, then it's about, well, what play haven't I read in a while, or what art can I ingest that will inspire me, that will help me be ready for whenever that next opportunity pops
up. Right. And I wanted to ask, because I know that you've been starting to write again, and that has kind of been an effort in that vein to have something to work on your own when you're not busy or not getting paid for your work. And I know that you were a writer in college and a writer on your own, but you've recently started collaborating and working on screenplays. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. It happened years ago we had all this free time because our time wasn't dictated for us the way it was at Florida State or at Juilliard. And it's not the royal we. me. I had all this free time, and I needed to fill it with artistically. And I found that preparing for auditions And at that time I was auditioning for, you know, maybe like a 2-line part on Smash or something. And so you don't really get a sense in roles like that, as we all know, to create a fully a 3-dimensional human being. And so I had that desire and that urge, and I had a lot of energy that wasn't being placed in a useful place for me. And so me and my very good friend Nick Choksi, he came at me with this idea about what if we do a play about this band, like a storyteller's type show about this band. And that's all I know. And I was like, all right, well, let's brainstorm. And so that's what my writing process has been now. It's just been brainstorming with Nick for years about what this, and it's a series of coffees and dinners and breakfasts and hours spent, you know, ingesting caffeine and also spitballing ideas back and forth. And so then once that project kind of came to fruition, God, after season, that was like 2015 or so, and my buddy Marty and I had this idea about these three Cuban baseball players trying to escape Cuba and trying to make it to the major leagues. And we had been talking about writing a screenplay together, and I thought, well, that's something. And so we went to our friend Mark Junick's retreat house, Make House, which some of you are familiar with.
Mark's
and,
been on the podcast, yeah.
Episode?
I don't know. Look it up. Sorry.
I don't have them memorized. But that was a tremendous
20-something.
Right. That was a tremendous gift as well to have a place where we could fill these ideas out. And now we've got a 20-page outline of what our screenplay is. And some of this came from, frankly, a fear of the blank page, you know? I'm looking at Jason right now. It's a tough thing as a writer, right? Where you're looking at that blank page and you're thinking, I have to create something beautiful, and I have to have pages by the end of the day. And I was just listening to Jason's episode today, and you're talking about how daydreaming, it's okay to go through a day where I don't crank out pages, but I do crank out ideas and thoughts. And maybe they're formless, and they don't have a way of being organized right now, but even firing those synapses will take me to filling that blank page at one point. And I found that collaborating with one of my closest friends has been so wonderful. So it's happened with Nick on the band play, and then Marty on the screenplay, and then me and Alejandro now have started collaborating on this play about, his working title right now is Borders Brothers. And I kind of love it. I love it. It's about what about the responsibility of first generation, Cuban Americans. You know, we're playing these two brothers, and what that responsibility is and how it manifests itself in our lives. And so these lessons that are imparted to us by the older generation, how we ingest them in separate ways, you know, as a working person in service of your family, or as an artist, you know, who's out on the world by yourself, you know. So right now we're very much in the opening beginnings of these thoughts, but I've found that combating the fear of that blank page, having a collaborator, is really helpful, but also keeps you in check. I have somebody that's holding me accountable, and vice versa.
Does it make you feel like you have a little bit more power when you're just auditioning, or?
Wow, that's a beautiful leading question, because it does.
Oh, good.
You know, on in those, there's so much of our lives as actors that we have no control over. And if I don't have something coming up this week, or I haven't booked anything in, you know, 6 months or 2 years or whatever, I have this creative refuge with my best friends, pretty much, where I can go and say whatever I want and think of whatever I want and make mistakes in an environment where I feel empowered and with artists who I trust, and vice versa. And that, to me, to walk away from a meeting like that is significantly more fulfilling than, you know, what happened at Mark Sack's office today, you know?
So guys, just to acknowledge this, I'm doing two interviews today, so it's gonna be a little shorter with each person. It's only gonna be a half hour. So There's going to be lots of things we don't get to talk about. So just to acknowledge that, on the heels of that, I wanted to ask you two things. The first one is, you've been lucky enough the last few years to do a lot of work in TV, coming out of many years in theater. So I wanted to ask you about what that was like, that transition, working between those two mediums, if you had any issues with defining success for yourself between them, all of that as an artist.
All right. I'm
sure it was like a shock to the system, but
yeah,
you've had the luck to kind of change mediums all of a sudden 3 years ago. So
yeah, and it truly has been a blessing in a lot of ways. And it's been a lot of on the job training, you know. I was lucky enough, my first gig out of Juilliard was a full season at Oregon Shakes. And so I did two Shakespeare plays, Measure for Measure and Julius Caesar, 120 performances of each. So I was there for 10 months, and it was 240 performances of Shakespeare. And the...
Which is amazing, right out of school. Like, what a training.
I talk to Richard Feldman about it, I periodically check in school, and I always say hi to my artistic psychoanalyst, Richard Feldman. And he... we always talk about it as the fifth year of training. And that's exactly what it was, you know. It for me, it was one of the best years of my life, because I was able to synthesize this kerfluffle of information that I got for those 4 years at Juilliard and do it independent of the teachers' voices. I didn't have their voices in my head. I just had my own artistry and these tremendous artists that I was surrounded by in this gorgeous valley in the middle of nowhere in Ashland, Oregon. And very much for those who've been there, it's pretty much the Disney World of theater, you know? They're doing 12 plays a year on three different state-of-the-art theaters. And people come from all over, you know, internationally to come see these plays. And it was amazing. It was amazing and a true blessing. And that sort of... you know, the dominoes started rolling, and I basically, it was two months into that contract that I missed you so much that I was like, oh, she's my wife, and so I'm proposing at the end of this year. So that was also part of what made 2011, everybody wins, but that's part of what made 2011 so special was in being away from you, I realized how important your presence was to my day-to-day life. And it was like my aha moment. And so for me, you know, you were the carrot at the end of that tunnel. And they offered me
I'm the carrot. I'll take it. I will take that.
And they offered me a another year, from January to November to play Mercutio and another role in Troilus and Cressida. And I was very fortunate to book Hamlet, which I did down in Sarasota. It was a fully bilingual production in repertory, which was a mind fuck. You know, we do a performance at 2 p.m. in English and then a performance at 8 p.m. in Spanish. And there's Giselle over there, was my Ophelia, stunning and beautiful and a tremendously challenging scene partner in a great way. We raised each other's games, and I felt that way about the whole cast. And so anyway, that was the momentum where I booked that, and it was like, well, play this dream role in two languages set in Cuba, and then we took the production down to Miami and closed. It was a lifetime. It was a project of a lifetime, but it also meant 4 months in Florida, and then I get to go home to my fiance, as opposed to 10 months in Oregon. In the long contract where you can't leave. So you're there for 10 months. And I just knew that I couldn't, obviously I flirted enough. We knew that I couldn't be away from you. And so I came back, and that's when Nick and I started working on the band play. And I got a random call from Telsey and Company saying, hey, we want you on for a couple episodes of Smash. Just we're filling in actors for this musical version of Dangerous Liaisons that they were doing. And for those of you who know me, that's not good casting. I don't belong there. But it in hindsight, it was a tremendous gift to be on set for 3 episodes. I didn't have a line, but I'm watching these tremendous actors like Sean Hayes and Megan Hilty do take after take after take and try different things. And I'm asking questions, obviously, and I've got my little notebook and I'm writing things down and trying to learn as much as possible. And then I went out to Louisville and did Whipping Man out there. And while I was in Louisville, I grew this huge beard to play this Confederate soldier. And the looking audition came about. And when that audition came about, I just knew. I was like, oh, I can do this. I don't know why I felt that way as a sweet, straight man to play this kind of really tortured gay. He was my polar opposite in a lot of ways, but there was something about the role where I felt like this guy is in me. And so I sent in tapes from Louisville, and it caught the eye of the director and Carmen Cuba, who cast it, and they invited me to come out to LA and test. And so I closed the show on a Saturday in Louisville, and Sunday I came here to New York, and we watched the Super Bowl, and spent the night with you, and then Monday I flew to LA, and Tuesday and Wednesday were the chemistry reads, and I was cast on Friday. So in a week, my whole life changed, and here I had this series regular role where it was like I had never spoken on camera before, and I show up to my first day of the pilot in San Francisco in March, and it's like, here, Frankie, here's your contract, all right, and take off your clothes and get in bed with that guy. And you start, and that was the first scene that I shot, is the two of us were in bed, we're jerking each other off, and I we're making out, and then he wants me to move in with him, and I relent, and I say yes. And it was baptism by fire in a lot of ways. I had never spoken on camera, and here I am already doing a vulnerable thing. And for those of you who've seen the show, it's, I was listening to Chris Perfetti's episode as well today, and he was talking about that show has a tremendous, where's that red beanie? He's here. Hey, bud. That show, for us, there's nothing to hide behind. For Jonathan and Murray and Chris and Raul and I and Danny and everyone, it's all about cracking open your ribs and exposing whatever's inside. And that was hard. But it's one of those things where stuff happens for a reason. And doing that play, Whipping Man in Louisville, which for me was one of the hardest theatrical experiences I ever had. For those of you who are not familiar with the play, I play a Confederate soldier who comes home to his newly freed slaves in 1865. Now the Civil War is over. He gets his leg chopped off at the first scene of the play, and he's immobile for the rest of the play. And for those of you who know me, that's a challenge, you know? And so I had to sit my butt. And this play is in the round, and so my back is to a third of the audience for the act one, and then act two, they move me to the other side, and my back is to that other half of the audience, and that was it. I had to sit there and trust that I was enough. And for my classmates who know, that was a 4-year-long battle that has since become an 11-year-long battle. You know, we all have our demons that we deal with, and for me, that's always been the demon in my work, is trusting that what I have, what I'm bringing, is enough, that I deserve to be in the company of these artists and these people. And that show, what was so beautiful about it was everybody came at it with such an open heart, that it made it very easy to be vulnerable, because you're looking at your scene partner and that person is so open that you have to match that and rise above as well. And so that's what we did for 2.5 years. And it was the best. It was the fucking best.
We're running out of time, but I did want to ask you also about, since you are a first generation Cuban American and a Latino actor, what are the challenges that you've found since school that have surprised you or not surprised you about the casting process, about the stereotypes that you've had to overcome, and how your thinking has maybe developed as about how you need to deal with those situations? Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, I was very conscious coming out of school that I didn't want a stage name. It felt to me that I didn't want to deny that part of myself.
listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.